From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, film director Liz Garbus takes an in-depth look at the life of singer and civil rights activist Nina Simone in a new Netflix documentary, and a conversation with Hollywood legend Robert Duvall, who takes on both the director's chair and the star role in the new film, Wild Horses. But first, Philip K. Howard is a best-selling author, attorney, and chair of Common Good, a nonpartisan nonprofit dedicated to restoring common sense in our nation. One of the keys, he says, is an extensive reexamination of the nation's laws. He joins us now to talk about his new book, a powerful critique of modern legal orthodoxy called The Rule of Nobody, Saving America from Dead Laws and Broken Government. Philip, good to have you on this program.
Nice to be with you, Tavis.
It occurs to me that good public policy to one might be abusive to me. So when we say dead laws, what are we talking about?
I mean, laws that have outlived their usefulness. Mm-hmm. I mean, laws that were passed, New Deal farm subsidies. It's been 75 years since the last farmer was starving, but we're spending $15 billion every year and giving it to corporate farmers. Well, mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. The $15 billion could be spent in ways that society really needs. And we have this system of law where we rarely go back and say, okay, we don't need that law mm-hmm. anymore, or this law should be adjusted because it's not working like we intended.
Why does our system not allow for lack of a better word, review of dead laws?
Well, first, people don't have the idea. Secondly, it's actually hard because every time there's a law, there's a special interest group around it. Mm-hmm. And the framers kind of made a mistake. They didn't realize it'd be 10 times harder to get rid of a law mm-hmm. or change it as it is to pass it in the first place, because people will do anything to avoid giving up, you know, what they have, the farmers or their farm subsidies or whatever it happens to be. So we just need to focus on the fact that if we want to move forward, we've got to get rid of some baggage or change it so that we can address tomorrow's problems, not 5 or 6 decades ago problems.
Yeah. But if Washington, this is my assessment at least, if Washington is bought and bossed by big money and big business, and a lot of that has to do with these lobbyists who line up
right.
K Street, I take your point made a moment earlier in this conversation. How do you fix that so long as there is somebody who is eating at that trough?
Well, the bad news here is that big change never happens with small ball.
Mm-hmm.
It always happens when there's pressure from the outside for big change. It happened in the 60s with the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. It happened in the 30s when people were on the street starving. It happened in the progressive era after decades of agitating that the corporate bosses were destroying child labor. You know, mm-hmm. who finally got regulation. It happened in the Civil War after decades of work by the abolitionists mm-hmm. that it was immoral to have slavery. So big change always comes in big gulps. And what's happened, it's not the first time it's happened in history, is that we're simply a mature society and we've got these piles and piles of laws. Mm-hmm. I'll give one really good example. So President Obama, duly elected by a majority of Americans, wanted to stimulate the economy in 2009. He got bipartisan support. He got $800 billion to do it. 30% of it was going to go to infrastructure. In the 5-year report released last year, turned out that 3.6% got spent on transportation infrastructure. And why is that? Not because the president didn't want to do it. It's because the president of the United States lacked the authority to approve even the most basic rebuilding projects. We're not talking about roads through virgin forest. We're talking mm-hmm. about rebuilding broken down bridges. Well, FDR, when they passed the Civilian Works Administration in November, I think it was 1933, within 7 weeks, the guy who ran the program, Harry Hopkins, had hired 2 million Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've got to give people back the authority that goes along with their jobs, you know, with their responsibility.
What was obstructing his authority in that regard?
The law had piled yeah. up. It had so many approvals by so many different agencies. You know, literally, any big project will require the approval of 20 or 30 different agencies. It's like negotiating an international treaty. And it's in the law. So the president can't ignore the law. The law says, well, then this department has to approve it. And it's all well-meaning, but somebody needs to be in charge.
I suspect that in this campaign that is now underway with Mrs. Clinton now declaring and Mr. Right. Rubio and Mr. Cruz and Mr. Paul and Mr. to come in the coming days, Everybody's running. You running?
Not yet. Everybody else is running.
I suspect that we're going to hear this phrase a gazillion times, certainly from the right.
Right.
Broken government. That's one of their favorite phrases, broken government, broken government, broken government. When you use the term for your subtitle, when you say broken government, what do you mean by that? Is our government really broken as you see it?
It's broken not because it's not doing the right things, because most of what government does, I argue it needs to do. Mm-hmm. We need to have regulation of the environment. We need to oversee nursing homes and daycare centers. Our freedom depends upon it. Mm-hmm. It's broken because the government officials supposedly in charge of doing that are tied to 1,000-page rule books, and they can never use their common sense. Mm-hmm. And it happens to tie up the citizens at the same time. So everybody goes through studies of it. People go through the day with their noses in rule books, and they can never actually be fair or if you're a teacher, you don't have the freedom to be spontaneous mm-hmm. and to make an exception or to do the things that make life work. And, you know, we had this bad idea that you could actually make things work properly if you only have the rules detailed enough. Mm-hmm. And what I argue in The Rule of Nobody is that's actually completely wrong. Law is not supposed to replace freedom. It's supposed to be a framework for mm-hmm. freedom. So, yes, let's set goals. Nursing homes should have a home-like setting and respect the dignity of the residents and have nutritious meals. Don't give them 1,000 rules that say food should be stored 15 centimeters above the floor, and windows should be no more than 3.5 feet above the floor. You know, all these sort of well-meaning rules, because it takes away the ability of the people running the nursing home and the government inspectors mm-hmm. to actually ask the question, is this a nice place? Mm-hmm. Are they really being nice to the resident?
I wonder whether or not, Philip, this problem, which is you've acutely laid out for us, I wonder whether this problem is made worse by the notion of states' rights. I mean, you've given a number of examples tonight that are examples at the federal level.
Right.
But when so much of those in government now want to push responsibilities and rights and authority and oversight to states, does that make this problem worse?
It can. Mm-hmm. So in the case of infrastructure, you've got an interstate, you mm-hmm. need power lines. You know, I think the authority ought to be with the federal government. You can't let every county through which the power line goes say yes or no. Mm-hmm. Although you never build a power line to take the energy from the wind farms to, mm-hmm. to the cities. In the case of local services, schools or nursing homes or things, I actually think there should be, at least initially, more authority locally, because that's what makes democracy important. Mm-hmm. It's closer to the ground. And my criticism of the Republicans is that they take the failure of government and they say, so let's get rid of government, Tea Party. Well, that's never going to happen. You know, the more interdependent the world becomes, the more we're going to need government protection to safeguard against lead paint on toys or whatever. But we do need to make democracy important and to make anything on the ground work. You need the people on the ground to be able to always ask the question, is this the right thing to do? And we've created this red tape jungle mm-hmm. that basically prevents both the president of the White House and the teacher in the schoolhouse from actually doing that.
We've been somewhat in the weeds, and I'm glad we were, because your book takes us into the weeds.
Right.
Well, what needs to be changed and how it ought to be fixed. So I appreciate that. Let me pull back for a second. You said something a moment ago that makes me think a bit more philosophically for this next turn in our conversation. You mentioned the Tea Party.
Right.
And it seems to me that part of what they started was a debate, which I think is still ongoing, about what the proper role of government is.
Right.
My question is, what do you make of that debate in its current frame about how we decide as the Demos what the proper role of government is or ought to be?
I think the debate today is almost entirely in the wrong dimension mm-hmm. because it's against no government versus big government. And I think what we need is a government, in many cases, that has oversight over almost all joint activities. And so law is about setting boundaries to prevent people from acting wrongfully. Mm-hmm. But government should hover, in many cases, further away from the activity and let people do the activity in their own way and only come in when they're doing it badly, instead of coming in with, I'm not exaggerating, 1,000-page rule books that put shackles on everybody and say, you just go through the day as if you're a robot following the rules. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way to run a free society. It's not a way to engage human energy and human love and all the emotions you need, you know, to make any social service, to use one example, to make it work.
Speaking of running government, you have a number of propositions in this book that you suggested we consider for how we can make this thing run better.
Right.
One of them is a citizens council
to
run things. Explain how that would work.
It's the idea of George Kennan. He's a famous diplomat who died maybe 10 years ago. Basically, it would be like a version of the Simpson-Bowles Commission on debt, where you get a group of elder statesmen to come in and say, hey, wait a minute, here's a way of working it better. But in this case, it would be a group of people appointed indirectly, but are leading citizens, which would have no power. Group would have no power. They couldn't tell people to do anything, but they would comment, since Kennan's idea, on how government was working. So they would take the current Congress and say, this is the most pathetic Congress that it's ever been in the United States of America. It can't do anything. All it does is stop things from happening and point fingers at the other side. And if it said that, then all of a sudden the newspapers, which today only, they take it seriously. They just report on what's happening. Mm-hmm. Now they would have a different frame of reference and say the Citizens Council is saying this, that Congress is failing and we need to come up with new ideas to get it moving again.
Philip K. Howard is his name. His new book is called The Rule of Nobody, Saving America from Dead Laws and Broken Government, now out in paperback. Philip K. Howard, good to have you on this program. Thanks for your work at Common Good.
Great to be with you, Tavis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Filmmaker Liz Garbus has tackled subjects ranging from prison life to torture to big-name personalities like Bobby Fischer and Marilyn Monroe over the course of her distinguished career, earning an Emmy and an Academy Award nomination for her work. In her newest project, she uses rare archival footage and never-before-heard recordings to paint an extraordinary portrait of the legendary recording artist and civil rights activist Nina Simone. The film is called What Happened, Miss Simone, and it premieres on June 26th on Netflix. Before we start our conversation, let's listen to a clip from What Happened, Miss Simone.
I've always thought that I was shaking people up, but now I want to go at it more, and I want to go at it more deliberately, and I want to go at it coldly. I want to shake people up so bad that when they leave a nightclub where I performed, I just want them to be to pieces.
Title, What Happened, Miss Simone, comes from?
Dr. Maya Angelou,
yeah.
An article she wrote in 1970 for Red Book. Nina had been a hero and a leader of the movement, and then she was gone. And Maya Angelou, she wasn't then Dr. Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
Maya Angelou was asking, you know, where had she gone? What had happened to her? And that's kind of the same question that the film is asking now in 2015.
When Maya Angelou was asking that question, where had she gone? What had happened to her? Why had she disappeared?
Nina had found, you know, as she called it, her purpose for the stage. Mm-hmm. And that purpose was, again, to use her words, to help her people. And she said, you know, an artist's duty is to reflect the times. And that's what Nina, you know, found as her mantra at that time. Towards the end of the 60s, with so many losses of so many leaders and her colleagues and her friends and the murders of Dr. Martin mm-hmm. Luther King and Malcolm X mm-hmm. and Medgar Evers and other leaders, Nina was done with the U.S. She was burnt out from the circuit. She was disappointed. She was heartbroken, and she left. She went to Barbados, to Liberia. and ultimately settled abroad for the rest of her life.
Yeah. I learned so much. First of all, I've seen this, as you know, and Liz and I sat for a conversation at the San Francisco Film Festival.
Yeah.
And I was honored to come up to do this with you. And I've seen this film a couple times since then because, first of all, there's so much in it. You have to look at it a couple times just to breathe and just to digest all that's there. But one of the most amazing things about it is the footage, the rare footage. And as you and I were saying before you came on, so much of it shot on film. So that gritty, it's so beautiful. But tell me about how you found all of this stuff.
It was like a scavenger hunt. You know, there's like one guy who says, you know, you should really talk to this guy, and then you should talk, but that guy's in Australia, and then the stuff is in his garage in France, and it became this kind of worldwide search. And, you know, it took a lot of time, and it took building a lot of trust. People are very protective of their Nina Simone, and I think Nina was different things to different people, and everyone's really attached to their version of Nina, their Nina. So it also took people trusting us and believing that we were going to do her justice. But then, you know, ultimately we were the recipients of a treasure trove of concerts, diaries, letters, interviews. So we really could kind of feel Nina present with us today, even though she's been gone for 12 years.
And the involvement, I mean on camera and behind camera, the involvement of her daughter seems to me to be crucial to this thing. And she brings some footage to the table, obviously, as well, of her father.
Yeah.
But tell me about Nina's daughter and the role that she played in the project.
Yeah, so Nina's daughter, you know, we had her blessing at the beginning of the film. I think she felt like Nina had been so misunderstood for so long and had been appropriated by so many different people. And Nina's daughter sort of felt like, you know, it was time for Nina to speak for herself. And she kind of handed over, she gave us her blessing, and she let me go as a filmmaker, and she let me find my Nina. And I found that Nina in this archival footage that we're talking about, and in the 100 hours of audio recordings that I have of Nina Simone that we use in the film. And then Lisa, she helped, and then she got out of the way. I mean, she didn't intervene in the creative process, but she told her story with such honesty in a way that I think those of us, even who have parents who are possibly less complex, you know, she told with such honesty and bravery, confronting the darkest moments, but still trusted that we would honor the great art and, you know, with empathy that Nina Simone was.
What struck me about her honesty, to your point, is that in being honest, there is, and we all, you know, we all have dark sides and night sides to our characters.
Yeah.
But her mother really had some issues.
Yeah.
Her father, as we say down south, sure enough had some issues.
Yeah.
And for her to be as honest about the issues that both of her parents had it's part, to me, what makes the film so authentic.
Yeah, it was a real gift. I mean, that honesty and that trust that she had. And to not, you know, like, who of us could look at a portrait of our lives or our families and say, oh, you know, not want to say, like, change that, fix this. I mean, Lisa really understood that she had to let the filmmaker tell a story finally. And thank goodness she did, because that is what I think it makes the film very honest and very true. And she had some hard times. But she still, you know, she balanced that anger and that love in a way that was very evolved. And I think we all should kind of aspire to that.
I think I said this to you. I hope I did. And if I didn't, I will say it now on the stage when we were in San Francisco for the premiere of this. I was a Nina Simone fan, have been for years. But it was only in watching this film that I really came to appreciate her as a songwriter in the way that I do now. Her lyricism.
Yes.
I mean, everybody knows the one song, you know.
Yeah.
But her lyricism is powerful.
She's a genius. I mean, if you read her, you know, we got access to her notes and her letters, and like there's like poetry like spinning out like in every way, and you know, Mississippi God poured out of her in, you know, 2 hours time. And not only her writing, but just the way she would recompose, you know, she would take a standard and infuse, like a jazz standard, and infuse classical and blues and folk, you know, and she'd totally transform a piece of music and make it just Nina Simone.
Right.
So even when she was taking material that existed, she completely reinvented it. And that's what makes her such an unforgettable artist. And so many artists today want to say, hey, Nina Simone, she's my hero, you know, she's my influence. And so many people are kind of coming around and honoring her now today. And I think that, you know, she's a good one to aspire to.
Well, let me take a different tact on that.
Okay.
My read on that is, you know me.
Yeah.
My read on that is it's a beautiful thing for people to see her as, you know, for her now to be positioned as people's heroine.
Yeah.
But that's no plaything. It's no simple thing.
That's right.
If you're going to call Nina Simone your hero, you better find a way in your music to do what Nina Simone did in her music. And most of these artists aren't trying to do that.
So you can
shout out Nina Simone all you want to.
Yeah.
But there's a whole, shouting her out is one thing.
Yeah.
Trying to walk in her shoes is quite another. And it wasn't, and by her own admission, it wasn't easy for her to walk in those shoes.
No, and I don't think she wanted to be in those shoes all the time. I mean, you know, her relationship with performance and entertaining and, you know, even, and the activism part was so complex and fraught. I mean, she called it a burden and a joy.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I'd rather have, you know, folks aspiring to Nina Simone than something empty. I mean, the music business today does not allow for the development of a Nina Simone. So, yeah, it's tough to find those voices out there. But, you know, there are people out there walking her shoes and who are trying to walk in those shoes and fill them. And the movement is building. And she's something great to aspire to.
It takes a great deal of courage and conviction and commitment and character to be a Nina Simone. That's my only point.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of people coming into, you know, I'm sure there'll be Nina Simone T-shirts and hats. And, I mean, stuff's already starting now. And part of that's because of your wonderful documentary, but there is this film that everybody's talking about now that is to come.
Yeah.
Zoe Saldana is starring in a Nina Simone movie. I assume you haven't seen it. I have not seen it yet. But what do you think or hope or believe the distinction will be between what you're providing in a documentary and what may come in this Zoe Saldana film?
Nina.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Nina.
Yeah.
You know, and which is not to say, I mean, Zoe Saldana is an amazing actress and, you know, she can, you know, who knows, you know, I don't have a dog in the race. Like, it could be something that contributes to our love and understanding of Nina, but it's not Nina. And we've had wonderful movies that have, you know, like brought Johnny Cash to life or Tina Turner. You know, maybe this can increase her fan base and increase people's understanding of her. But, you know, Nina, there's nothing like Nina. And so I'm lucky to have worked with Nina. Yeah.
What do you hope, as a filmmaker, that the takeaway will be from your film, What Happened, Miss Simone?
I hope that, you know, more people will listen to Nina and have that kind of rich, inspiring, three-dimensional experience that I have now when I listen to her music and that you have. I think she left such a gift to all of us, and I just kind of want to be spreading that around.
You did a great job.
Oh, thank you.
It is an amazing film project called What Happened, Miss Simone, by a wonderful documentarian named Liz Garvis, and I am so grateful to her, as you will be when you get a chance to see this, because you will learn so much about Nina Simone that you didn't know. And I think, to your point, Liz, we're going to appreciate her a great deal more in large measure because of your work and your service through this project. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have
you
on.
Put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You better stop the things you do.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. It isn't enough to describe Robert Duvall as one of the screen's greatest actors. He is, in fact, one of Hollywood's living legends. Over the course of a career spanning more than six decades now, Duvall has delivered some of the most iconic performances in cinematic history, including signature roles in films like The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, and Tender Mercies, for which he won the Academy Award. His newest film, which he co-wrote and directed, is called Wild Horses, and in it, Duvall plays a Texas rancher with a dark past who's seeking to redeem his relationships with his two adult sons. Before we start our conversation, let's hear a scene from Wild Horses.
I'm very sorry that I couldn't understand you. I'm sorry that when you were all grown up, I made it all about me. Because like most men, I wanted a perfect family. But like most men, I was not a perfect husband or a perfect father. Yeah. And I'm sorry because I know we cannot start over. And that's what I am most sorry about. But I want you to know, I accept you as you are because you're my son.
Yeah. I'm sorry, too. Mm-hmm. I've missed you.
Yeah.
And I accept you as you are because you're my dad. And you're the only dad I got.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
I think as that scene underscores, this film, more than anything else, as I see it, is really about family.
Yes.
But there's a lot of other stuff going in here, going on in here, though.
A lot
going on. How would you describe it? Because I don't want to give the big
secret
away.
You did it better than I did just now.
No. I don't want to give it away, man.
I couldn't sum up what this movie's about, but I found a thing in the Bible that's a tale that is told.
Mm-hmm.
A tale meaning a story.
Yeah.
And it's about a family that the father has shortcomings, obviously.
Yeah.
He kicks his son off the ranch because he's gay.
Yeah.
Those are the only two things I left in from when I optioned it, because there was really no script there.
Right.
That and a lady Texas Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And he's hiding something in his past. And but, you know, this is mainly dealing with such good actors.
Yeah.
I got really good actors, you know, James Franco and Josh mm-hmm. Hartnett and Adriana Barraza. She's she's that wonderful Mexican actress.
Yeah.
From has her own theater company, and Angie Cepeda and my wife. And I use the real Rangers.
Yeah.
You know, I like to mix the non-actors, the first-time actors with the professional actors.
Yeah.
Because I think if they step over that line with confidence, sometimes they can put a professional actor on notice because they have no bad habits.
Yeah.
So I use the real Rangers because they're used to undercover work and everything.
You like horses and farms and
ranches.
Ranches. And
these
kind. You. I'll come to the story in just a second, but it seems to me that you're drawn to films that have these sort of aesthetics in them.
Although I did play Joseph Stalin one time.
Yes, you did.
And a Cuban barber.
Yeah.
But the point is, I do like that. When I was 13, 14, at the end of the World War II, we went. My father was off fighting the Nazis, and he was a professional naval officer. We went to my uncle's cattle and sheep ranch in northern Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, I still remember, a lot of my past I don't want to remember. But that is great memories for me because it kind of formed a personal infrastructure for me for Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because my uncle said I always had a natural seat on a horse. So, you know, when I became an actor, that was kind of the genesis of it when I was on that ranch in Montana.
Western element. Yeah,
absolutely.
Those Western elements, yeah.
Yeah.
When I don't want to ask you or push you or beg you to go to some place you don't want to go.
I'll go anywhere you say. Well, you lead me.
You lead me. Yeah, no, let Jesus lead you.
You lead me. Come on.
There you go. I want to talk about the apostle a little bit later, too.
Okay.
Again, I love that. Let Jesus lead you. But you said something that I'd be remiss if I didn't go back and get. You said there are a lot of things about your past that you don't want to remember. I'm not going to ask you to remember them. But what did you mean by that, things you don't want to remember?
Well, I just don't. I don't relish the past necessarily.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm on wife number four.
Yeah. You know,
and that's
she's a beauty.
She's
though.
Wonderful.
She's brilliant. And she's smart. Yeah.
Oh, she's smart.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. And she never lets me forget it.
Yeah.
And she got the. She never acted before. She said, "If you think you're going to put that woman in a tango movie, I'm going to play the part."
Yeah, yeah.
So she got the best notices and never let me forget it. So.
Yeah.
So she's great. She.
But you don't like going back. You don't like thinking about the past.
I do certain things, certain flashes. Certain flashes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I would think as we, I want to think in my own life at least that as I get older, that I'll be at a place where I'll be able to look back on some of this stuff and appreciate it a little bit more in a way that only that distance in the rearview mirror can give you.
Yeah, well, we grow.
Yeah.
We have to grow.
Yeah.
We have to get better in our lives.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten better, you know, socially with people.
Because
I came from a military background, which was a little bit sheltered.
Mm-hmm.
I was always a late bloomer. I think the young actors today are better than ever.
Yeah.
Because they have so many things at their disposal, you know, so many legitimate shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
But I came from a family, you know, we had to catch up in certain ways.
Yeah.
But my father, who came from a military background, went to the Naval Academy when he was 16.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him saying one time, when a racial thing came up, there's no place in the U.S. Constitution for second-class citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. No.
Very interesting.
When you say that we all have to get better, and we do, as you look back over all the stuff that you've done in your Hollywood career, can you see yourself clearly getting better over those films? I mean, you've always been so great to me. I mean, you say, I'm wondering what you mean by getting better in your acting.
Well, I don't know if I get better. I get maybe looser. And more. I was always a late bloomer. After, mm-hmm. after The Godfather, everybody, mm-hmm. that was a kind of a catalyst,
sure.
for many of us.
Right.
And I figured 10 years after that, kind of it would be a catalyst for me, that era for mm-hmm. me. So I was always, so in my mid-50s and a little bit before was some of my best work. And maybe since then,
yeah.
you learn to relax and be, you know, so forth.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when I did the Lonesome Dove,
mm.
I said, now I can retire. I've done something.
Yeah.
I said, that's my Hamlet or Henry V.
It is
that's
great.
Mine.
It is great work, though.
And the yeah. English have Shakespeare, the French, Molière, the Russians have, you know, what they have.
They got Chekhov.
Chekhov.
Yeah.
But we have the Western.
Yeah.
The Western is ours.
Yeah. A whole lot of us agree with you. But why did you think that Lonesome Dove was your...
Well, because he had 16 weeks to develop, you
yeah.
know, and it was a very interesting guy. He said, why do you think we killed off all the people that were so interesting to begin with?
Right.
He had great regrets about certain things he did. I was fortunate enough to be in the two great film epics of the 20th century, Godfather 1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
and Lonesome Dove. And I went into the kitchen one day of Lonesome Dove. I said, boys, we're making the Godfather of Westerns. which I think we did, you know. You know, so.
Yeah.
And it was just, I'm doing a lot of reading now in Texas history right mm-hmm. now. Oh, my God, some yeah. of it's crazy. Because I have something I'm developing with right. AMC from a great novel. It's a Western.
Yeah.
And, boy, the history of any country, but yeah. even Texas is amazing.
Yeah.
Robert E. Lee told them how to build the main house on the King Ranch before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Then he was called back, refused to fight for the North, and Lincoln momentarily reached out to Garibaldi in Europe to come lead the Union troops. But it didn't work, and then he got Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So all that history of Texas that built up on yeah. I'm reading now is kind of interesting.
When you said earlier, a couple of times, you said, Mr. Duvall, that you...
Call me Bob, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Bobby D or
yeah,
anything.
Bobby D.
Or Roberto.
You said a couple of times in this conversation that, that you've always been a late bloomer.
Yeah, I think so.
What's been the advantage to you of being a late bloomer? And I ask that because I was just reading an article the other day about the fact that for some people, life does begin at a different age.
I'm 84 years old.
Well, you're 84 now, but you bloomed a long time. You bloomed and blossomed a long time ago. But
there's a line from the Lonesome Dove, the older the violin, the sweeter the music.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I like that. The older the violin, the sweeter the music. I love it. What's the advantage, though? Because there are people who don't peak in their 20s or 30s or 40s. What's the advantage to being somebody who blooms late or peaks late?
Well, I just, you know, that I can keep going, and hopefully, you know.
Yeah.
I always, when I was younger, I said to the Neighborhood Playhouse, I said, I always want to think of myself in the potential. And
mm-hmm.
until the day I stop doing it,
right.
I want to try to do different things and get better. You know,
yeah.
I want to do that.
Let me ask, why are you still working this hard? Let me get this question out first.
I can take so many naps a
no.
day.
I mean, I raise it because you are your legacy is so not just established but cemented, and it's one thing to take a part in a film here or there, but dude, you're still writing and producing and directing and starring. Why are you still working so hard?
I don't know. It's not so hard. But, you know, we only had 23 days to do this last film.
To my point, why are you working so hard? 23 days.
It's over.
Yeah.
It's over. No more. You know, maybe I'll take a cameo here and there
yeah.
and so forth and so on. But some of these wonderful young actors I'd like to work with. And
It's just, you know, it's the time will come.
Yeah.
When I have to quit, the time will come.
How will you love this so much and you're so good at it? When that time comes, how will you know? Will you have to be told?
Both.
Yeah.
My wife will help.
She'll nudge you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, it'll come. It'll come. You know, whenever.
Yeah.
Whenever.
Yeah. We established earlier that you've always loved, you know, movies with Western themes. But how, beyond that, how do you go about these days choosing the kinds of projects that you want to do? At this point in your life, how do you make choices? You
know, same as always, yeah, in the past. Instinct.
Yeah.
What can I do with this part that's a little different?
Yeah.
Who's directing? Who else is in it?
Mm-hmm.
And you just, from the part first and then the total project.
Yeah.
You know, to start with the character.
Yeah. Since I last saw you, and I've seen it half a dozen times, and it speaks to me on so many different levels, but since I last saw you, you were nominated for another Academy Award for The Judge.
Yeah.
That was a great film. From your perspective, tell me about that project.
Well, at first I turned it down.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to play an incontinent old man,
yeah,
messing himself and everything.
Yeah.
And I said, I can't do it. It's too much. And then I said, well, I was told I should do it by certain people, my wife and my agent. And once I decided that I was going to do it, I had to just jump in and do it,
mm-hmm,
completely, mm-hmm, and definitively. So we had 60 days to do that. While it's here, we had 23 days on Wild Horses. Mm-hmm. And the Downeys are wonderful to work with, he and his wife. Very accessible people, terrific people to work for. And it was a very demanding part.
Yeah.
And at one point, I went nuts one day. I don't get along with directors sometimes.
Yeah.
So the director went to Billy Bob and said, how do you direct the ball? What do you do? Billy said, very simple, just say action and cut.
Yeah.
That's all.
Action and cut.
Don't, you know.
Yeah.
No, but a good director and just a great team they had.
Yeah.
And it was great working with Billy Bob again. I've known him a long time. And it was good to do a big, you know.
Big budget.
Big budget.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers movie,
yeah,
you know. Because I do like the small independent films, but I, mm-hmm, like the big ones too, you know. Yeah.
So how do you process, how do you feel when you end up with an Academy Award nomination for something that you initially turned down and didn't want to do?
Well, that's happened a couple of times before.
I turned things down, and then I retook it, yeah,
and it worked out. Well, it felt good.
Yeah.
And I knew I wasn't going to win because the guy that won was very good.
Yeah.
Was very good, but. You know, it's okay to go to the Academy. I wanted to have my wife look good in her dress. She looked great.
Yeah.
She could Twitter, get everything. More than the other girl who had a, yeah, dress like that. So now we're sitting there, and the best part of the evening, we left a little early with guys sitting for the foreign films.
Yeah.
And here was the Russian guy practicing his victory speech, practicing.
Yeah.
And the Polish guy got up and won. And you couldn't shut the Polish guy up.
Yeah.
Which is a film called Ida.
Mm-hmm.
You should see it. It's magnificent.
Yeah.
Polish film.
What in this film, Wild Horses, what is it that you want us to take away from the film?
Oh, that's hard to say because
it's not in it.
I'm not big on message film. Whatever you take.
Yeah.
Take something positive, hopefully, you know, that people grow and change.
Yeah.
They may not change, they shift.
Sure.
They shift. And my character shifts and accepts his son, even though he's a gay son.
Yeah.
And just, you know, life goes on. We try to get better, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, everything's percentages.
Yeah.
Even when I played Joseph Stalin, I had to find something vulnerable about the man.
And what was that?
His ex-wife that committed suicide.
Right.
And years later, I put up the picture of her there, and she was very alluring anyway, the actress.
Mm-hmm.
So I said at one point to the director, you better come in quick. Something's going to happen. Forget the wide shot. Come in quick.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very emotional. So you know, even bad guys can have vulnerable sides to them. So everything's percentages. 80% one day, it might be 120 the other. And the next day, it might reverse itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at life in percentages, you know.
It's a long way from Boo Radley, isn't it?
Yeah. The wonderful Horton Foote, he helped me. Horton Foote in the beginning and Francis Coppola did The Godfather. Those people, those two people, very different perceptions. They were very helpful in my early days as an actor.
I raise that. You're so kind. I mean, you're so modest. You just moved right past that. I had one of the great honors of my life was just a year or so ago to be asked by the Academy to host the evening where they brought out for the first time the remastered version of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, nice.
I was so honored to be asked to do it.
And I gave
a little talk about it and, you know, introduced the film, and then we had a conversation after. But to look at you back then, and a part with no words.
I had one line that cut it.
Yeah. What?
Where? Yeah. He says, where's home? Where? They cut it, which was okay.
But that is such, your presence, in that film was so powerful and so palpable without words. Yeah. I mean, I only say that because it, watching you in that scene so many times all over the years has said something to me about the profundity and the power that can be found in silence even.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I had a theory then, and not so much now. Then I had a feeling that when I got goose pimples, I was on the right track.
Oh, yeah.
So in those scenes behind the door and with the boy, I got goose pimples as an actor. And I said, oh, back in my mind, I know I'm doing okay. You know? Yeah. It was a wonderful part to start a movie career with.
Oh, yeah, your very first part.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And who knew they'd let you talk years later?
Yeah, right. I know.
When you look back on your career, I mean, obviously you're still doing stuff. Back to Kill a Mockingbird, that first role. Has this thing turned out the way you thought this career? Has it turned out the way you thought or hoped it would?
I guess.
Yeah.
It's hard to shape something.
Yeah.
You try to shape your course as best you can, but then when you plan things, something might come around the corner that surprises you that's better than what you're planning.
Yeah.
So you always have to be open to those surprises, that, like the judge that came around. I never knew that would happen, that came around the corner.
Somebody told me a long time ago, I love this line, that we plan and God laughs. We plan and God laughs. We plan certain things in our lives, and the stuff that he has in store for us sometimes is so much better.
It could be.
And so much different than what we think.
That's interesting.
What we think is in our best interest. Yeah. Speaking of God, I mentioned earlier, and I got to come back to it. I will never see you.
E.V. Hill's the name of that preacher.
E.V. Hill, here, Zion Baptist Church here in Los Angeles. Yeah. We were talking since he arrived at the green room today. Since he came on stage, we've been trying to think of a name of a preacher, and he couldn't. It just came to him. E.V. Hill was an amazing preacher.
He preached his own wife's funeral.
He did.
Yeah.
E.V. Hill was a great preacher here in L.A. And you raised that because when you came in today, I said to you how just the other night I was watching for the umpteenth time, The Apostle, and that film. And see, I was laughing when you said earlier in this conversation that you don't really do message films. That wasn't a message film, but if ever there were a film that you did that had a whole bunch of messages in it,
yeah,
The Apostle speaks on so many different levels.
I went to everybody was afraid to do the Howard Stern show.
Right.
I was the first to do it.
Yeah.
So I did him for The Apostle, and I went down to do Pat Robertson.
Right.
And I said, oh, Pat Robertson, he got it. And everybody, Pat Robertson, oh, we saw you on the Howard Stern show. I couldn't believe it.
Pat Robertson, Howard Stern.
Right, I know.
That's pretty good.
But you know, I got a letter on my wall in Virginia opposite my Oscar from Brando. I like it almost better than my Oscar. He was like our mentor, really, Brando, the great Brando.
Sure.
He loved what we did with The Apostle. And I heard that Billy Graham liked it, too. So I got it from the religious and from the secular.
Yeah.
I got it from both sides.
What does it feel like? And I've heard others. I'm trying to think of who it was. It'll come to me in just a second. Who told me that they didn't read reviews. It'll come to me. A guest on this program. And they said they didn't read reviews because one day Marlon Brando saw them out and about somewhere. And Marlon Brando said to them, I saw you in the project, and you were great. You got a great future in front of you.
Yeah. Who was that?
And I'm trying to think of the actor. They'll come to me in a second. Whoever the actor was, he said to me that from that point on, he never read reviews. Because his thing was, if Marlon Brando said, I'm a good actor,
but I could care less. That doesn't mean every performance.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Yeah. You know.
But I read that.
I don't read reviews. I used to. I don't read reviews now either.
Yeah. I raise that only because, I mean, when Marlon, how does it feel when Marlon Brando tells you that you're doing good work?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I wasn't particularly close to him. I knew him some because I worked with him two or three times. But that was nice to hear that, to see that.
All right, so is there anything... You're working on a new project for AMC, you mentioned, that you're developing that now.
Yes.
But at this stage in your life, anything on your theatrical bucket list that you... Anything that you have not done in film that you...
Well, I was supposed to play Don Quixote, but it fell through.
Yeah.
And when he wrote the novel Lonesome Dove, he patterned some of it after Cervantes. Mm-hmm. You know, knights and shining, mm-hmm. saving ladies. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to happen. So, you know, we'll see. There might be something coming around the corner to surprise me.
Yeah.
You know, before they wipe the drool, you see.
Please. So retirement is a word that you would never, that would never come out of your mouth.
It'll come out. It'll come up sometime soon, yeah. It will.
I'm not buying it.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, I'll take cameos maybe with some wonderful young, you know. I'm very good friends with Rooster McConaughey in Texas, mm-hmm. who's the older brother of Matthew, and he was so great.
Right.
He was perfect in Dallas Buyers
Club. He was amazing, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Perfect. So, and there's some of the young actors now are wonderful. Tom Hardy from England.
Yeah.
You know him?
I know who he is, absolutely. You know, I don't know him, I know who he is.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot of, the doors are open.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't know him, but I had asked Denzel Washington, your father was a Pentecostal preacher. Would he be in a movie? He said, I don't think. He was from Virginia.
Yeah.
So I don't know Denzel. I worked with him once, but I don't really know him. So when the movie came out, I got a message on my phone, thank you for the movie, in Virginia.
Yeah.
And I don't
From Denzel.
After he's a wonderful actor.
He's doing...
Western.
He is. I can say this is news. I'm not letting you see because I see him at the gym all the time. And he's gone now because they're filming in Baton Rouge.
Right.
So they're kind of, he's doing his first Western.
Yeah, you're right.
I'll give you the last word. The best reason to see Wild Horses is?
For the acting.
Yeah.
Very good actors in it, you know. I was fortunate to get these wonderful actors, you know.
Yeah.
And the Texas Rangers to be in it. So it was, my wife's got her now a Brazilian blue belt in jiu-jitsu. She studied law enforcement and
You better behave yourself.
Yeah, well, I know. Because she can run faster than I can. Yeah.
The great Robert Duvall. Always honored to have him on this program. The new project is called Wild Horses. And all the best to you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Good to see you, my friend.
Me.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.